Thank you for watching and listening to the
Hello.
Salty Witches podcast.
Yes, hello, Saltines.
Hello. We are back, ready to do the things. I don't know what we're talking about, though.
We have listener questions.
I do.
We had a listener question last two listener questions now that I recall. I was thinking I had answered one. I was going to do a mini episode for y'all last week, and I started to record. I did record. Went on for about a half an hour and then realized at the end of that recording that there was no sound. For some reason, the volume did not pick up. There was no sound. So I'm blaming Mercury. Why not? Everybody Mercury. Else gets to. Why don't I get to?
Mercury and Gatorade, man.
Exactly. Anyway, so on that mini episode, though, I was going to answer these two questions. Okay, and I want to make sure. Oh, I've got references here. On the one, because where did you go? Because I didn't have this answer. So we got a question from a Saltine concerning the Toadsmen.
Okay.
The practice of the Toadsmen originating in particular areas of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And that really isn't my wheelhouse. I'm not super up on English tradcraft. I know enough from the traditions in that area to to speak on those things on occasion, but this one was new for me as well. So I contacted our buddy George.
Would be a good resource.
You can follow George on social media at The Devil's Finger.
Yes.
George is one of our amazing readers here in the shop. If you're ever looking for a
tarot reader,
a palm reader, he does a little bit of astrology. He does a lot of stuff. Spell consultations and spell work. He also Reiki. Is teaching.
Yeah,
He's also teaching in the shop now. He's doing a class on traditional English witchcraft.
Yes, he is.
With a focus on the cunning work of Cornish Gaelic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I contacted him because I'm like, okay, he's gonna know far better than I. Anyway, so I asked him about the Toadsmen, right? And he got back to me with a few different things. The first thing that I want to provide are the references that he gave me. He mentioned three books. One is Witchcraft and Secret Societies in Rural England by Nigel Pennick, and that's Pennick. He also mentioned Borax, 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 The Jewel of Midnight by Douglas Kincaid,
mm-hmm.
and the book The Devil's Dozen by Gemma Gary, I believe. Is it Gemma Gary?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also has information on a particular rite that is done in one area of the UK within the practices that would be identified with Toadsmen. George went on to tell me that the Toadsmen, the practices that they go through, and in essence, historically, the way that they have been kind of viewed by other cunning folk coming from that area of the world, the Toadsmen, from the sound of it, they don't really seem like they were really viewed favorably. Like the type of magic that they did, the type of work that they did was seen to be like very sinister and kind of shadowy. And because of that, they were really kind of seen as like, oh, hands off, we don't do this. For that reason, and because of some of the other cultural significances of the UK in that area, the people of that area, this is a closed practice. You would need to find a legitimate teacher or someone to bring you into this practice. Apparently in different areas of the UK, and again, I'm kind of paraphrasing what George got back to me with here, they do different rites, or there are different rites that are done to actually become a Toadsman. And apparently Toadsmen fall into a family of practices, of cunning practices, folk practices in the UK that have a lot to do with heightening your own psychic powers,
mm-hmm.
Animal communication in particular, which would make a lot of sense, you know, when you think about like a community of people that was really, I mean, even to this day, so dependent upon its animals.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, livestock, whatever the animal may be. Right. So, you know, there are other groups, I guess, in going there, there are other groups like the horsemen and the millers, I guess, coming from that area. This is what George is telling me, the horsemen and the millers, that would have similar rites and practices. But the horsemen and the millers would have been seen to be more, they were more publicly acceptable
mm-hmm.
than the Toadsmen, I guess. Again, Toadsmen were kind of the dark, you know, the shady, more malevolent Spooky. Practitioners. Scary, spooky, right? Not to say they were evil necessarily, but some of their practices are really interesting. They apparently have to do this very elaborate ritual involving a toad. And if you look at the historical information around that, the toad was very often like physically harmed or even killed, really in really violent ways as a component of this ritual. From that point, the body of the toad had to be basically desiccated. The bones were ultimately harvested, I think, after the toad's body was floated down a river for several miles, and then you had to go and collect the toad's body. And yeah, and it's like, it was a lot. Like our magical ancestors, like these people did and do their work.
Yeah.
Like I was reading up on some of this and just some of the other things that we're aware of that other traditional practices more commonly involved in years past. And I'm just going to say, like, we have gotten so lazy with our witchcraft. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. These people had to do a lot. Anyway, so apparently the spirits that toadsmen work with also are believed to cause madness. And so that was one of the other things George mentioned, that not only are the initial rites that are done to become a toadsman very harrowing and kind of scary and gross, beyond that, the work itself can actually be really scary. There are a lot of stories, a lot of lore around toadsmen who basically are driven mad by the spirits that they connect with through the process of doing the work that they do. So I'm going to say, and this is, of course, just my opinion, but I would say this would definitely, to me, seem to be a practice that you maybe want to hold off on until you are a little more experienced in just general folk and witchcraft practices. You know, make sure you've got a good solid ground or foundation in yourself and in your work before you try to dig into these. Beyond that, again, you're going to have to find somebody that is going to be able to bring you into this kind of stuff, because again, these are technically, these are closed practices, or is a closed practice. So anyway, hopefully that is of help. I'm so sorry it took us so long to get an answer to you on that one. I know that that's a question that's been kind of floating around out there for a few weeks now. Let's see. Next, we had a question from, do you want to do one of yours? Let's do one of yours.
So this one comes from Allison from Ali_of_the_woods on Instagram or Wolf and Parchment on TikTok. My question is surrounding sleep paralysis, specifically regarding the spiritual component rather than the medical. Someone close to me has suddenly begun to experience episodes of sleep paralysis following lucid dreams. The lucid dreams are intense and involve their religion, loved ones who have passed, and a feeling of anxiety. These episodes are terrifying for this individual. I'd love to know your paranormal / spiritual opinion on sleep paralysis in this context. While I've experienced lucid dreams with my past loved ones, I've never experienced sleep paralysis, and so I'm not sure what advice to give this person. Also, please note that this person is seeking medical help in the meantime to rule out anything that may be happening health-wise. Thank you, Allison.
Shall I give my speech paralysis speech, or do you want to?
You go ahead and give your speech paralysis speech. I'm in a fiber flare day out, so not that any of you care, but I'm foggy and owie, so I'm going to let Mike answer a lot of this.
So you mentioned that you're looking for the spiritual causes of this, but I am going to kind of go into some of the medical, the physiological, the physical medical symptoms of what we identify as sleep paralysis, because a lot of people have this phenomenon and they immediately go like worst case scenario around, like, oh, something horribly wrong, has gone wrong, you know, I'm spiritually being attacked, you know, whatever, right? And very often they discount the mundane things. So we all understand, well, I shouldn't say we all understand, but when we sleep, when we access states of sleep, our mind actually has to kind of move through a series of different wavelengths to be able to get us from a purely awake, coherent, conscious state to kind of a deeper sleep state where we kind of shift more into the subconscious mind, hopefully. When this happens, there are people out there who have an issue or have some sort of issue with how the chemicals in their brain that are supposed to trigger those different wavelengths of brain function, how those chemicals actually kind of move through their system. You know, and because of that, there would seem to be for some people, at least, almost like a misfiring, you know, where like you lay down, you go to sleep, and one of the chemicals that's submitted that moves through your brain and your nervous system that's supposed to kind of relax your muscles, right, and make your body more sedate and calm physically, that maybe that chemical works really, really well. But the other chemical that's supposed to also like basically take you down from a fully awake, coherent state doesn't. So you'll have situations where people are physically feeling symptoms of at least a temporary paralysis or a difficulty in moving the physical body, even though the mind could still be completely coherent. So that's one of the things that can cause a sleep paralysis situation that is purely medical. And there are medications and treatments, I believe, that can address this. So it's good that your friend is doing a little more research into the medical possibilities of what's happening here. On a spiritual level, really, we typically see one thing happening or we see the kind of the major cause for this. And that really has a lot to do with people who astral project. When you astral project, much like the example I was just making about how your brain wavelengths change to access deeper sleep states, when you astral project, a very common or very similar thing happens where one component of your consciousness is projected outward while the other part of you kind of stays, you know, here at home base, right? And your physical body and your base physical senses will function to the extent that they need to, because, you know, you're still alive, right? You know, and you're still capable of not capable. What am I trying to say? You're still in essence, you're in something that would still be very similar to a sleep state, right? Even though one part of you is kind of like up and out and doing the whatever you're doing, right? What happens with sleep paralysis is when people project, when they send that part of them out, or when that part of them actually begins to return to the physical body, to reintegrate into the physical body, there's a few moments there where the heightened senses of the part of you that is projected outward, when that part of you comes back into the space where your physical body is, the heightened senses that that part of you spiritually has will still pick up on the activity and the things that are going on in the room around you. And if there are spirits wandering through that space, that spiritual component of your being is going to sense those spirits and potentially even see, visually have a sight or sighting of those spirits around you in your room, around your body as you lay there, you know, sleeping, right? So when that part of you comes back, and then completely reintegrates, there are a few seconds there where your physical body basically needs to catch up. And the component of you, the part of you, your spirit that moved back in after being in the astral, will bring the sense and the visual memory of those spiritual energies around you back to your conscious thinking brain. So it's this weird thing where like you're in two halves, in essence, having different experiences, or your senses are functioning at different levels. And then you kind of like mash those two halves back together, and they're both bringing like, you know, all that they are back together. So, so you're in this weird liminal space for a few seconds. And again, that can affect physical movement in the body. That can be, or create an issue where you still feel a sense of paralysis in the body physically. You're unable to move, but you're also still very alert and awake, and even potentially very psychically alert and awake because of that temporary, you know, reintegration of those different aspects of your being. So those are the two most common explanations for what we identify as sleep paralysis. More often than not, this is not a scary kind of a thing. This does not, well, okay, let me rephrase that. It's not that it isn't scary, because that's not my judgment to make. That's, you know, the people who are dealing with it, right? But this doesn't have to be a scary thing. This is very much one of these situations where I kind of tell people, as it's come up over the years and I've had this conversation prior, I kind of let people know, like, just take a moment, try to like center yourself, just try to relax, try to sit. And it's difficult, right? Because we feel so vulnerable, right? Particularly if we've seen other spiritual energies in that space around us, right? We don't want to be vulnerable in that situation. But more often than not, these are not spirits that are going to really be harming you. You know, if they wanted to harm you, they'd be doing it whether you were fully awake or asleep, right? But to just kind of just take a moment to try to relax, to do what you can to try to bring your brain, your analytical thinking mind back to a full state of alertness, right? Because once you do that, then your nervous system will respond, and your body will then start to gain function. You'll start to gain sense and function and movement again. And it's tricky. It's tricky not to be afraid in a moment like that, right? I don't think any of us like to be vulnerable and incapable of taking action if we need to, right? It's a very primal kind of a thing, right? Yeah. Like no one likes to be, you know, well, I won't say no one likes to be tied down. I know there are some people who like to be tied down, but that's a different conversation. anyway, so did I answer that?
Yes, you did.
Okay, cool. All right, okay. me?
Yes.
Next? Okay. All right. So the other question that we had was from our buddy Jack.
Okay.
Over at Songs and Sorcery. Go and give them a follow. Another great podcaster. Jack asked a question last week, and I unfortunately wasn't able to get back to them with an answer in time. But the question that they asked was actually sensitive to or specific to the solar eclipse that just happened yesterday.
Okay.
Or was it yesterday?
It was this yesterday. Morning?
Anyway. They wanted to know basically what we kind of the idea is what we recommend or what we kind of would suggest people do spiritually around that time, around the phase of an eclipse. And answering this, to be honest, is a little tricky because I think different cultures will have different ideas,
mm-hmm.
not just cultures, but even different spiritual traditions will have different ideas. I think that in a lot of cultures, that is seen as a very powerful time. And it is. It is a very powerful time. In most forms of traditional witchcraft and folk magic, and even in particular indigenous communities and their spiritual practices, the eclipse is really not a time to be doing a lot of active spiritual work.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing spiritual work during the eclipse, it really any. And when I say eclipse, that's either lunar or solar. That is really a time, I think, to be focusing on internal, like introspective or shadow work primarily. And I say that mainly because when you're dealing with eclipse energy, you're dealing with what in essence kind of comes down to is a balancing of extremes. You've got this, particularly with this one that just occurred, right? You've got this very strong solar energy, but then you've got the balancing influence of a lunar energy in there, right? And it works the same way for a lunar eclipse. So you need to kind of look at how we have these very strong polar kinds of energies now kind of brought together. Keep doing this tonight. I was just doing this before where I was talking about merging and reintegrating after sleep paralysis and astral travel work. Anyway, that's the bringing of together. We could just sit and do this for like 15 minutes.
I think I should do the podcast. And I think we should bring Dator and Oxy on here.
That's where your brain is right now?
That's what happened with this. I don't know why. I think it's because I saw the nails.
Oh. Anyway, I'm okay with that. That's fine. Wendy actually had a really good idea, and I'll talk to you about it in a few minutes.
Sure.
Because I think it's a really good idea on a future podcast episode. Teasers. excuse me. When you're dealing with energies that are so extreme, right? When I say extreme, I mean like in a lot of spiritual views, like the sun and the moon really sit kind of like completely opposite of each other on a mm-hmm. spectrum energetically or spiritually, which we know is really not true, right? Because the moon is in essence just basically a big mirror to the sun, right?
Yeah.
In terms of its light, you know, the moon has its own gravitational forces and things, right? But anyway, but when you're doing that, that energy, that mix of energies during that eclipse phase is going to be very powerful, but it's also going to be very unstable and chaotic. And any spiritual work that you really are likely to do in that phase is something that is likely to have like a lot of really good oomph at the start, but is then also very likely to kind of like peter off. Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Peter off.
Putter
off. Ebb. I prefer ebb. I don't like Peter in there. It makes my mind wander in odd ways. So it tends to ebb very quickly because that's the nature of an eclipse, right? Like it comes on, boom, here it is. Boom, boom, now it's gone, right? And so the results of a spell in particular can be like really like powerful at the beginning, but they're not going to last. They're not going to be very long term. And because of the chaotic nature of an eclipse, you're going to see a lot of really weird twists and turns around what ultimately happens to get to the goal of any kind of working that you do during an eclipse phase. And it doesn't mean bad necessarily, you know, but if you're somebody who likes to, you know, kind of like map out all the details and have a clear plan on how this thing is going to materialize in your life, you probably don't want to do spell work on an eclipse. So much chaos, so much static, and a lot of just weird collaterals that pop up.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do anything for the eclipse, what I would recommend actually is maybe to do some sort of ritual work where you can give honor to both the moon and the sun, the animistic spirits of the moon and sun. Or if you're someone like us who works with a tradition that honors both a lunar and a solar deity, to do some sort of rite, maybe to honor those two deities, right? As they kind of work together and balance each other, right? You know, there are things that you can do within the realm of ritual, but I wouldn't necessarily work spellcraft. I wouldn't do spells during an eclipse, you know. And there are some cultures out there where like the eclipse is like seen as like, this is a really bad thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You have anything that you want to add to that?
No, not really. I think this eclipse is just...
The eclipses are really weird. They're
Let me rephrase that. The eclipse itself wasn't stupid. It's the reaction from everyone around.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
The eclipse. Oh, yeah. Lionsgate. Oh, and all this other stuff. And I'm just like, it's another fucking celestial event that's happened multiple times a year sometimes.
Well, it's like, it's very much like the retrograde.
Yeah.
Right? Because that was one of the ones that we were hearing lately was like, oh, we're in a retrograde and there's an eclipse. And it's like, there are retrogrades and eclipses all the time. And yeah, the ones that I love the most are like the crazy light workers, like the new fundamentalist Christians, we call them the, mm-hmm. you know, the light workers, the new agers. And I'm just talking like the extreme ones where like every time we have an event like this, like they've got to be like, oh, it's the end of the world. Right. What was the one I was seeing? Like there was like soul ascension.
Oh,
and it was basically it was like some light worker version of the rapture that was supposed to occur yesterday during this eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And I love when they do that because it's like every time one of these kinds of events happens, they come out with that shit, you know, and then the event passes and you're like, well, we're all still here and nothing changed. The world is still a burning garbage can, you know. And then they always come back with a, oh, well, it happened, but it happened on a more subtle energetic level. And you're probably just not spiritually attuned enough to be able to feel it, you know? And I have those conversations and with people, and I just have to laugh at just the stupidity and the ignorance of these people. anyway, it's like the Christian prophets, like every couple of years, they're like, oh, it's the end of days. The end of day is the apocalypse is coming. The apocalypse is coming. And it's like, okay, well, didn't you already say this like 14 times? And yet here we still are.
It's just jumping one cult to another.
It's like, if you're worried about the apocalypse, why don't you maybe sell two or three of your mansions and help the world a little bit, you asshole? Anyway, so yeah, but you're right. The fear is so weird because people who live in fear, people who operate from a position of fear or anxiety or around these kinds of celestial events, I'm like, I don't know what you're doing, but it's definitely not a spiritual path. Because if you are that riddled by fear and ego, you have grown in like no way at all.
Yeah.
You know, like just stop pretending, right? You just need a hobby.
Yeah.
Right. Leave this shit alone because clearly you're not doing it. Not for real. Anyway. So it's just funny. It's just funny. And yeah. And I'll stop being bitchy now. Anyway, did you have another question?
I do. This comes from Magical Megs. I'm a big fan of podcasts. I'll admit I haven't gotten through the entire episode library, so I'm not sure if this has already been covered or not. But I was wondering if you could go over the warning signs of psychic and magical scams and grifters in one of your upcoming episodes. We haven't really touched on that. We just kind of touch on it as it happens.
We'll talk about that for a few minutes.
I can riff on that. So here's the thing. They're everywhere. Anyone who promises that they're that the thing that they're offering you is a 100% guarantee is a scammer. Okay, nothing is ever 100%. And I say that being someone who does spell work that consistently works with.
Well, you're sounding pretty close to these people there.
I'm saying that
consistently works
with people for spell work. Okay. And so because of that, what ends up happening is I always have to let my clients know, like, there's always a chance that this might not work, but here's the things we can do to sway these things into your benefit or what have you. Real psychic practitioners, real psychics are not going to reach out to you and say, hello, beloved Grand Rising. I feel a strong connection to your ancestors. Message me now with only your initials and I will tell you who's around you. There's several Facebook groups that I somehow have ended up becoming a part of. And like the scams are real. Like, and it's always old, middle-aged, elderly white women sometimes who are just like the scam, like, hi, I'm offering a free reading to anyone who puts their initials down in the comments. And then someone does. And then the next response is, message me privately for your personal accurate reading. And it's like, this is a scam.
I was just going through my notes because I thought I might have one more listener question, but I couldn't find it.
So those are scams. A witch is also never going to reach out to you and be like, hey, so I saw that you have a haunted house. I'm totes going to like help you with that. Mm-hmm. We're always going to make you have to approach us first. Ethically, that's just what it is. Ethically, that's just the sound thing to do.
Yeah, consent is very much a thing in these kinds of things. And we're that's one of the reasons we don't seek you out.
Mm-hmm.
Is the true core of consent is you seeking us. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as you do that, then we know that like, oh yeah, you're consenting for us to do this for you.
Yeah. So there's a lot that goes into that. The easiest way to tell if someone's a scammer, also, I would like to say this, is their prices. There are people, like, I can see both sides of the coin. You know, if someone's charging $300 for a spell consultation, then that tells me one of two things. This person doesn't know what they're doing, and they're really arrogant on themselves, and they're going to use a chime candle for a spell that's going to require more than chime candle, but they're going to charge $300 for it. Or this is someone who really takes their job seriously and is like, if this person is serious, they're going to book this consultation with me. They're going to pay me this. And then anything else that goes on top of it, because they want it. But in the meantime, they also need to make sure that they let you know, like, yeah, this, like, there's not a guarantee here.
Yeah.
You know, when someone sits down with a consultation for me, I have a sliding scale. If it's something as simple as a candle spell, the consultation fee covers that candle. I take them out of the shop. I have them purchase the candle. If I need them to purchase an herb, I have them purchase the herb. They hand it over to me. I do the things and then I text them to come pick it up. Easy. Okay. Not a problem. Now, if it's something that's going to be a little bit more intense, then this requires planning on both my end and their end. And that's how you can also tell that the person you're working with is not a scammer or someone who has really good ethics, because you should always have homework. Mm-hmm. You should always have homework at the end of a reading, at the end of a consultation, at the end of a Reiki session. There should always be some sort of follow-up. It should never just be, here you go.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't tell you how many times I have had to do that with people. So those are some of the big signs of scams and like illegitimate things that I usually see. Also other signs like grammar, honestly, like
now you're hating on people's talk.
No. Like if it sounds like it's been written by a bot, chances are it's written by a bot. And if you're like, well, I don't know what that sounds like. And when I read something, I don't hear the voice. If it says powerful spell, love, bring back relationship partner now, probably a bot.
Well, that could also maybe be someone who's maybe not fully literate, trying to put themselves out there. You know, and I've known practitioners over the years that, you know, like maybe they didn't have a full mastery of English, right? Or whatever language is the dominant one. And they've spoken broken English. And then that's been something that's also come through in their writing. So I'm playing devil's advocate.
Anyway, so while I can see that as well, there's also a point where like,
what about practitioners who put a lot of fear into their work?
Yeah.
And that they're constantly trying to like put fear into their clients. Like, oh, you know, like we see this a lot and it's all over the place and it's really, really unfortunate. But we see the situation where you go to somebody and an unethical and a not legit practitioner of whatever kind, right? And they do their consultation and they do their initial spell for you. And then they usually always have like some hook in that spell, right? But they're like, take this candle and bring it back and I'll read the wax for you, right? And then you bring the candle back and they're like, oh my God, all the wax is telling me that you're going to die horribly unless I do another spell for you. And the next spell is going to be 5 times more expensive than the first, but you have to do it because if you don't, you'll die.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just sitting there like, whoa, I just asked you to do a spell to help me get a new job. Where the fuck is all this coming from? Right. You know, but that's how they work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I would also add to what you've provided so far, like any practitioner who is going to do that to you, any practitioner that's going to have you come back or who is going to contact you after having done work for you, that's going to be like, oh, I just sense there's a bad energy around you. I need to do more work for you. Give me $5,000, right?
Yeah.
Those people are con artists. Because if they really were doing the good work that they were supposed to do for you to begin with, whatever it was that they were telling you was now around you wouldn't be there. So be mindful of that. Well, that's the one that I think I see that pisses me off the most, because not only are those people, not only have they been financially taken advantage of, but they come away from that experience with a lot of fear.
Yeah.
And that fear is hard to break.
Yeah. Cause then they go to the next reader and the next reader is just
they come and see us and we're like, there's nothing wrong with you. Like, what's your problem? Like, there's nothing wrong with you. And they're like, and they're insistent. Like, I know this person did something. I know that I have a bad energy. And it's like, I'm telling you right now that you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And you should probably never work with this person again. What bothers me the most about those situations is it's like a lot of the times those people, they hear that and then like, and they refuse to believe. They're like, I just know I'm cursed. I just know there's something wrong. And it's like, I'm telling you there isn't. And, you know, and you came to me, I'm a professional and an ethical one. I'm not going to send you out of here in a situation where I know you're going to be in trouble. But you're choosing to believe that you're in danger. You're choosing to believe the lie, even though you know it's one that is horribly defeating and awful for you.
Yeah.
You know, but they double down.
Yep.
Like they need that. I think it's a very weird kind of like pick me kind of thing, right? Where like they need to be special, even if it means that what makes them special is the fact that they're like in danger.
Yeah.
You know, it's the weirdest thing. We had one of those in the shop just this week, actually. It was a very sad situation. But because our reader is ethical, she invited that client to instead go and meet with a mental health expert, because even though she told them that the problem they were dealing with was not only not supernatural in nature, two, not really there, wasn't real, didn't exist, and this person had been scammed, unfortunately, in a couple of different ways, but they left here like upset. They left here basically like arguing with the practitioner, like, oh no, I just know. And it's like, if you just know, then why did you come and see me?
Yeah, today? If you just know, then why are you here?
You know?
Here, like, buy this Jason Miller book, Protection and Reversal Magic. There you go.
Anyway, sorry, I'll shut up.
So, another question. Hi, Carlos from Michigan here. Over the past few weeks,
like Carlos.
I have seen the element of water used in mainstream media as magic practices, things like a pool of water that takes you somewhere else. I've read about it in books like The Chronicles of Narnia, TV shows, and anime. Why is mainstream media using water as a portal? Am I missing something? I have been thinking about the element a lot over the past few weeks. Water gives life as we need it to live. It cleans us, it reflects, it flows and carries you. It can hold things within it, as in a glass or a lake or the ocean. Water seems to have more power than what I originally thought. How do I use water in spell work other than a purification outlet? I can't tell you why media is doing what they are doing, but waters have always been seen as a portal to another world, especially like oceans, lands, and seas and stuff. You know, you are going from the dry land into the ocean, and there's dark, spooky things down there, things that you don't know.
So there's other significance for that, though, right? Because if you look at, particularly in Western cultures, well, not just Western cultures, because of the movement of the sun, the water was kind of always seen, if you were living somewhere where you could see the horizon of a body of water or along a body of water, particularly as the sun was setting. a lot of old communities kind of have stories around like how the sea kind of devours the sun, right? Like the sun moves down into the ocean at night, right? And night is when things get dark and scary, right? So the ocean was, in many cultures, was often seen to be not only a devourer of light, but also in a positive sense, maybe like the place where the sun went to slumber, right? But while the sun was slumbering, like you were left alone in the cold and dark, right? Because of that, though, I think that large bodies of water were always associated with liminal spaces, and kind of like we see like water in the West is often associated with, like the doorway to the to death is in the West, right? Or to the realm of the dead is in the West, right? So we see a lot of those things. I also think that some of what they're talking about here might be relevant to scrying.
Yeah.
Because while you're not actively moving to a different place or utilizing the water as a portal for movement, you are utilizing it as a portal for sight.
Yeah. Like a window.
Yeah.
Yeah. So other ways you could use water in magic other than purity. Water can be used a lot of different ways. You know, obviously you do have your purifications, you have your washes and stuff like that, but you also have different things like war water. Water that's collected during particular times of the day. I'm not talking moon water or eclipse water.
Yeah.
I'm talking water that's collected
like during a thunderstorm.
During a thunderstorm, you know, and they're always it's always thought more as a conduit. So because water is thought of more as a conduit, wherever this water is, and because water holds memory, it brings the energy of that memory to whatever you're working.
Water is also, on a magical level, I want to add, beyond cleansing, purification, scrying, certainly water scrying, water in ritual work is used to as an offering. Most spirits, particularly your ancestors, your dead, will appreciate offerings of water. Water also, because it has the ability to alter its form, right? It can move from a vapor to a liquid to a solid as it becomes ice, right? Water is also really effective for binding work and for asserting boundaries. Those of you who maybe have like heard of or have done like the freezer bind, where you like throw somebody in a little baggie of water into the freezer and the water freezes and kind of binds them up, right? Binding work. You can use water in the same way. Even without freezing it, I actually have a spell at home on my altar right now that's been there for about 4 years, where I have somebody like kind of like completely surrounded by water. And the idea is that that is meant to kind of hinder their ability to really reach anything solid, to be able to really kind of gain footing in any real way that would create problems for people. And I want to be really clear on this. This is not an I'm a wicked witch kind of a bad spell. Like this is a shitty person. This is actually a group of shitty people. And they delighted for many, many years in the area in taking advantage of and stirring trouble and causing just a lot of grief and pain for people within the local pagan and witch community. And after I had a run-in with them, I'm like, nope, you're done doing this. You're done doing this to people. You're not going to do it to me. You're not going to do it to anybody fucking else. And so I did this spell, which in essence kind of has them like floating, like in stasis, but they're surrounded by water. And I think it's worked because they've gotten quieter. They're not causing the trouble that they were at one point. Anyway, so you can use it for a lot of things. You know, be creative, right? Use it for your tinctures and things too, right? If you're someone that likes to work with plant spirits, and you're not going to poison yourself, right? But you can infuse your water with herbs, like teas, right? And incorporate those spirits into your ritual work and spell work that way. You actually take that energy into yourself. Oh gosh, I'm thinking of other ways.
God, water's good for healing.
Water's very good for healing. Yeah, very much so. Really, it kind of, God, I mean, once you start to kind of let your imagination run, once you start to work creatively within your own practice, you will find your own uses for these things. And anything that you determine water can do for you in your spell work, and you actually are seeing results, like it's actually doing the thing that you believe it does, even if no one else in the world does that same thing with water, and other people are even telling you like, oh, water doesn't do that, but you're getting results, you're doing witchcraft. You're doing good witchcraft. And it's your own thing, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Agreed. Next listener question.
Oh, you had more. Oh, God, I didn't
realize. Yes, okay. Okay.
You are busy.
I'm not sure if this topic has been discussed before, but I think it would be interesting to hear about the history of broomsticks, their traditional uses in witchcraft and myths. Can you provide some home cleansing ritual slash spell that incorporates sweeping? Will a plastic broom work for this, or should one made of wood be used instead? Should we make our own? Side question, different herbs and crystals have certain correspondences, and I would assume that different varieties of wood also have correspondences. Can you go into this a bit? If there is a recommended source for wooden tools, brooms, is there a recommended source for wooden tools, brooms, wands, staffs, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so
kind of pick those, like, yeah, we'll pick one on one because we got a few.
So broomsticks have been used in pretty much every folk practice. Used for protection, they've been used for cleansing, they've been used for direction. It was an easy way to hide your walking staff. You know, it was an easy way to do those things. Also, if you were walking alone in the woods at night and your torch went out or you needed a torch, you had a broom. Okay. Magically, we would see that they are feminine in nature, even though they
not always,
but, you know, depending on how they stand. Bristles up is feminine, bristles down is masculine usually. And the reason being is because when the bristles are up, it represents the pubic hair of the female parts.
Yes.
The simple home cleansing spells that require sweeping.
So you're just going to go there?
Yeah.
That's going to be it for your answer on that one?
I mean, you can go ahead and add.
Well, I think you're going to... I just wanted to add, since they mentioned specifically mythology and stories around that, I think you're going to find historically two cultures that have regular use or acknowledgement of the broom as a spiritual tool. One of those is going to be some of the cunning practices originating in the UK. Mm-hmm. You're also going to have, going back to old Africa. Mm-hmm. And there, I believe, is it jungle? There's an Orisha that actually carries a broom.
I don't think so. You and I have had this conversation before.
Well, there's an old spirit. I don't. Maybe it's not Chango. Maybe it's another.
But
there is.
Idea of jumping a broom being a traditional African tradition.
No, I'm not talking about that.
Because one of my professors who was from Africa was like, yeah, no, that's not something that was ever done.
No, it's not. Hold on one second. I'm Googling. I'm looking it up.
Brooms are used a lot in hoodoo and conjure.
There is an a god in African practices, ATRs, that carries a broom. And he's kind of an interesting spirit. I'm not finding anything now. That's okay. These are, for the most part, these are all closed practices anyway. But there is a spirit in that pantheon of gods that is often found in different practices within ATRs that carries a broom. And it's kind of interesting because there's a very dominant masculine kind of an energy to this god. He actually, if I believe, he's like a god of storms and war. But he carries a very special form of like ritual broom, and the idea is that, like, in at least in his stories anyway, the broom is kind of seen as a weapon. It's something that he uses as a god that has a very strong like destroyer archetype. Mm-hmm. He uses the broom to basically kind of like sweep away, like that's kind of how he like removes obstacles. That's kind of like how he like, you know, works anyway. So, and there are people like in that particular practice that will appeal to this spirit, they appeal to this deity to like remove obstacles and things. And the idea is like he comes in with like a sweep of his broom, which is also in sense kind of the same way as like saying like a god that like comes in with like a sword. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I'm just gonna cut this through this, right? Only now you're sweeping away, right? So it can be associated with very like very traditional masculine kinds of energy and god kind of energy, but I've never been up on the jumping the broom thing, and I don't believe that originates in the UK, even though a lot of people would like to insist that it does. Anyway,
well, the jumping the broom thing originated actually in like slave days. It was a game.
Yeah,
it was a game by the masters. Actually, that was the whole purpose.
I think it might. Since that's where you're going with that, I think it does also have like older roots. But again, those aren't roots that go to like the UK. Those are roots that go to other cultures around the world.
Yes. All right. Simple rituals or cleansing spells that incorporate sweeping. Sweeping.
Huh?
Sweeping. That is cleansing.
Yeah.
It's just like don't overcomplicate it. You can get your broom and you could totally like run around and cackle and do all that stuff and cast your fucking circle and what the fuck ever you want to do. I don't give a shit. But the act of physically cleaning something, and I can't stress this enough for everyone out there who thinks you need to overload the entire, and this is coming from someone who loves smoke cleansing. It's coming from someone who uses subfumigation a lot. You don't need to replace all of the fucking oxygen and air in your house, in your space with smoke to do a cleansing. If you just physically clean the space with things that you've magically enchanted and empowered for cleansing, you're doing a cleansing. Don't overcomplicate it. Like, and that's coming from someone who loves ritual and ceremony and shit like that. Like, don't fucking overcomplicate it. You know, when I sweep and I cleanse our home, it is literally I sweep. As I'm sweeping, the traditional way that I was taught is you start from the back and you move to the front. Okay. So you sweep from the back, move to the front, get everything up, you collect it and you throw it out. Same with mopping. Depending on what you're doing, if you are mopping and you're trying to bring in something, you start at the front and you work your way back. If you're trying to do protection, you usually start in one corner and work your way to the next and so on and so forth. So all these things that we see in practices that are more folk oriented, whether that's conjuring root work, hoodoo, even Italian folk magic, stuff like that. If you are physically doing something and cleaning your space, it is magical. You don't need a fancy spell and incantation for it, but you do need to turn your focus and your energy to it. And while you're sweeping, you should probably be speaking out loud that as I sweep this mess away, so too do I sweep away the mess of negative energy or malicious forces, or I don't know, look up your favorite charmed incantation for sweeping. I don't know.
Don't be a pop culture witch.
Whatever. Do whatever you want to do. But the act of physical cleaning also cleanses the energy.
I need to add to this. I think your fibro flare is making you like, you just want to get through this really quickly. And that's okay. I know time is precious and you're not feeling well. But I want to say your broom is a couple notes on what Austin was just sharing. I like to go into like little witchy shops, but I always have to kind of giggle to myself when I go into a witchy shop and they have like brooms available to buy. And the brooms are like basically like really flimsy and no more than decorative kinds of items. And I think a lot of people buy those kinds of brooms without realizing like your ritual broom, if you choose one to incorporate that into your work, like that thing should be fucking functional.
Yes. Just like your knife.
So like sweep your floors with your ritual broom. Make sure if you're going to do that, make sure you buy one. It doesn't matter what it is. And it doesn't have to be something you buy in a witchcraft shop. Shit, go to the grocery store and buy one out of the cleaning supply aisle.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. A broom is a fucking broom. If it's hard for you to get into the zone around using a broom for spiritual work, then visualize it as simply just a means of channeling the energy. It would be something comparable to like a wand or a dagger. It's just a magical focus or an item that allows you to transfer your intent or carry your intent. And you can use your broom to maybe spread like powders if you're doing like some sort of work where you're involving powders that you're putting along a floor or along the threshold of your door, right? Or your washes. Like we've got a spell that we do on occasion where we actually take like, and we dip the broom like into water just a little bit. So just the tips of the broom head, the broom bristles get wet and then you sweep with that. Right. But it's a way to kind of disperse like a blessed water around mm-hmm. a particular area, right. In a more even way than just throwing your water all out. Right. So you can use those things. You can, as Austin mentioned, you can flip that broom on its head and with bristles up, walk through your space and like you're energetically sweeping, right? There are lots of methods, lots of ways to work with brooms.
Yes. Will a plastic broom work or should we use one made of wood? Should we make our own? It's always going to be more powerful if you make your own, but they can be a little bit of a mess because it's a lot of work.
And you have to have really strong hands.
Yeah. Plastic broom will work just fine.
Yeah.
A broom's a broom.
Yeah, a plastic one's not going to be a problem, particularly if you take some effort to kind of like make it more than it is. Like if you can sigilize it in some capacity, even like painting sigils down the handle.
Varieties of wood also have correspondences. Yes, they do. Can you go into these a bit? Yeah, really, it's going to depend on tradition, but
An area of the
an
world,
area
a
of the
culture,
world.
because we use, like in the Mediterranean and in Latin America, rue is a really common herb. But if you go to other places in the world, nobody fucking uses rue. Like, I'm always surprised when people walk into the shop and they're like, oh, I've never used rue. And I'm like, what? You know, but like they're practicing some like really, I won't say weird, but like just some very different, you know, magic that originates in like, you know, like Northern Europe somewhere, right? Where like rue doesn't grow here. You know, so of course your magical ancestors never used rue, right? So, and it's much the same for trees and wood, right?
Yeah, so it depends on the area of your world. You know, someone in, oh God, I don't know, Russia probably doesn't have access to things like
Palm trees.
palm trees. You know, a magical practitioner who's based in Italy is going to work with the woods that are around there, and you're going to see a lot of pines, evergreens. Evergreens are everywhere.
Yeah.
You're also going to see oaks, walnuts, nut trees, fruit trees, lemon trees, stuff like that. You're going to see a lot of stuff like that. So it all depends on where you're at. But I will share some of my favorite woods that I have
Yeah,
worked
go
with.
for it. Or like maybe some general ones that are a little bit easier to find.
Yeah. I love working with pine wood. Pine wood's so protective. It's really easy to get your hands on. You can find it pretty much anywhere. It dries really, really well. It's protective. It's cleansing. It's really great for those things. It
Pine
also
has
has,
a lot of associations with fire.
yeah, and so it's very good for those things. I also really like walnut. Walnut can be a little bit harder to get your hands on, but not really. Like, it's actually pretty easy to find.
Again, it kind of depends on the area of the
Area
world
of the
you're in.
world. I mean, we live in the 21st century, so you could literally just go online and order
Yeah,
from someone.
it's true. I think that's how all the people in the in Ireland are affording their living these days. They're all going out and harvesting black wood or blackthorn
Blackthorn, yeah.
branches and things and shipping them all over the world.
Strangely enough, blackthorn actually does grow wild in the States.
In certain areas, yeah, you can find it, yeah.
So it depends on what's in your area. In places like the South, weeping willows are going to be very prominent.
And have a lot of significance to the practices, the spiritual practices of that area of the world.
Exactly. So you need to know where it's at. Looking like you're in, they say Arizona Saltines. So woods that would be around your area, probably not much.
They get like, I think they get like a scrub oak. They're actually depending on the Arizona. My grandparents lived in Prescott for years, and they had like pine trees and fir trees. Like they were that area. So yeah. So don't. I mean, Arizona is a little more diverse. It's not all just desert. But you'd have to again you look more specifically at the area of Arizona that you were in.
Yeah.
And
So
if not, you know, anything nearby, maybe consider, you know, maybe making a couple hours drive, you
yep.
know, to a place where, you know, you can get a particular tree. When working with trees
Maple.
and
Maple is really
woods,
easy to get as well.
maple's good. And some of those trees have really interesting associations. Like we were talking with oh, I'm so terrible. I never remember her name. But she came in looking for significance around cherry
Oh,
wood.
Leah.
Leah, thank you. Leah. Yes, Leah. So I wanted to say Laura, and I'm like, that's not right. But she was looking for cherry, and you know, and in kind of talking with her on that, you know, it's like cherry is a wood that is really commonly associated with like love and passion, you know, and like the sweet things in life, you know, which is what cherries ultimately have magical associations with. It's the animistic spirit of the wood that we're really working with. You
Yeah.
want to talk about that at all? It's like it's not the tree itself
Yeah, it's not the tree itself.
or the
It's
wood itself.
the spirit that encompasses that tree or that plant. Like all rosemary holds the spirit of rosemary. So all rosemary, whatever variety, is going to be good for the baseline things of rosemary. And then, you know, if it's some different type of rosemary, it's going to have some other things.
And you cultivate a relationship with the spirit,
yes,
the animistic spirit. That's the reason why we would maybe consider working with different woods,
mm-hmm.
and why we work with different herbs and stones and things is each of those spirits kind of have their own personality and energy,
mm-hmm.
and they're all going to be good at different things.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I love ebony. I love the wood ebony. And I have a very special wand that was made for me by a friend who I love it. It's a great wand. I don't really work with wands, but it's beautiful and I love it. Great for protection.
Sure.
Banishment, blasting, all that great stuff. But then I also have a wand that someone over here got me. It's made of ash, and ash is really good for any form of magical work. And it's been carved into a serpent. So you also have to take into account when you're working with woods, if it's been carved into a particular thing, because it's also going to carry the animistic spirit of that. So because my ash wand was carved into a serpent, not only does it carry the spirit, the animistic properties and spirit of ash, it also carries the animistic and spiritual properties of serpent. So
yes,
food for thought. There you go. I think we answered those questions.
Could be.
Yes. Recommended sources on wooden tools. Go to your local shops.
I don't mean like they mean sources on the meanings of woods or like actually where to get.
Probably where to get them.
The good thing about the tools that you would make out of wood most commonly, like staves or wands, really are the two that really kind of come to mind most. There mm-hmm. are others, depending on your practice and your tradition.
Yeah.
But really, I'm going to say like the ones that you probably really prepare yourself.
Yeah, the ones that you actually go out into the world yourself, and find.
Like, you know, and you might need to like go to a hardware store and maybe pick up like a good knife that's good for whittling, right? Or for kind of cutting down or trimming down wood, right? Unless you're lucky enough to actually have like, you know, like some access to some carpentry equipment. But creating your own wand or carving down your own staff, like that is such a powerful process. And mm-hmm. by the time you're done, that ritual tool is going to be unlike any other that you could find
mm-hmm.
because you put energy into that. And in the process, you transmuted the energy and combined or and partnered with the animistic spirit of the tree or the, you know, whatever the wood came from. Right. It's just very powerful
mm-hmm.
Experience. But I know that a lot of like if you're in your area, if you're in Arizona, I'm sure you must have these nearby. But if you go to like a lot of the like the trading posts, like the Native American or Indigenous American trading posts or places like that, a lot of times they'll actually have carved wood items
mm-hmm.
that are like handmade, handcrafted, that are always really beautiful
mm-hmm. and
powerful. If you're ordering online, you can order, I think you can get things like that from like Azure Green. Azure Green is a good distributor for ritual tools. I don't know what they have in the realm of wooden tools.
I have no idea.
I think they have wands and things.
Yeah.
There
you go. That's all the questions I had.
All right. Well, that's pretty much it. We didn't really have a topic tonight. So we answered some questions and kind of talked a little bit. So I didn't really have anything else. We need to have a topic here in the next little bit. Think on that, will you?
I will.
Okay.
I'm already gonna have one going through my head.
Cool. Sounds good.
Okay. Well, that's it. Thank you for listening to us ramble and babble. And sorry if I was grumpy. I just
well, I mean, we are the salty witches, so
yeah, I was a little too salty today. Sorry. I mean, anyway, thank you, saltines.
Thank you.